Welcome to episode 3 of the Donnybrook Podcast. That's right, folks. We've got a name.
Finally.
With me today in our studio is Amanda.
Good evening.
And John.
You keep calling this a studio. This is not really a studio.
It is a pretty majestic studio.
It's a magnificent old... How old is this church?
100 years.
100 years old?
A little over.
It's on the historic registry, isn't it? The Boise
think
Historic.
It was yes. Built in the 20s, maybe 30s.
I think it's chiseled onto the outside of the building so that we could
okay,
go look
I'll
at
go
it sometime.
It.
It was a beautiful Catholic church, and
then the Protestants got a hold of it.
The carpet is hideous, but otherwise we haven't damaged it too badly.
This carpet belongs at the Portland Airport.
When the Catholics left, they took all the stained glass. So we have these beautiful stained glass windows. And then in the bit where you would have the beautiful icon, it's just kind of plain glass.
We did have to get rid of the icons, apparently.
Yes, apparently.
We all have to, we need to do an episode on iconography and significance of it in the Eastern Orthodox tradition and Catholicism.
We'll just have to wait till our friend Kevin's in town. And then this will be a real Donnybrook.
That would be a Donnybrook. Kevin, if you ever listen to this, you're welcome to come and defend iconography. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think so. So what is a Donnybrook anyway? I'm looking it up here so we can actually get an official doc.
I'm pretty sure the unofficial John definition of it's a fight, but it. At least when I'm thinking of it, I'm thinking of kind of a friendly fight, kind of similar to like the Irish, how you settle your differences in Ireland and kind of throw
down. In The Quiet Man, right?
The John Wayne Quiet Man?
John Wayne and the guy
Marine
John
O'Hara.
Wayne is fighting or having this fight all through the town and in the river.
And like stop halfway through and have a beer and then get into a fight over who's going to pay for the beer.
Okay, here, it's a scene of uproar and disorder, a heated argument. Raucous, ideological Donnybrooks.
That's about perfect.
I think that would be just about
especially
right.
If we disagreed a little bit more.
Yeah, okay. Who's gonna be the more disagreeable tonight? Should we draw straws?
I think that we'll have to. Right, I think by nature I'm the most disagreeable. It's that or John.
Disagreementizing.
I don't. I think you're,
now we're gonna.
You're probably
it.
The most. I'm probably the most cynical.
Yes.
As opposed to disagreeable, or not. I don't know. Disagreeable is not the right word, but
yeah, disagreeable is a really negative way to describe
maybe?
Oneself.
I would say you're more countercultural.
Yes.
Than I am,
and
I'm more cynical.
I'm very
and David's
idealistic.
Just happy.
Yeah, David's
like
very happy.
David's
people.
Just
yes.
Springy and. Whatever that, what's the personality test that compares people to animals and one of them is a golden retriever?
That's David.
That is David.
Woo-hoo!
David. Yeah. If David had a tail.
It would be thumping, 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 thumping all the time.
Wag, 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 wag.
Okay, so what's first on the menu for tonight?
First on the, I thought you had a really interesting thing that you were going to bring up about hero worship, or how do we evaluate? What were your thoughts on that?
So that started with the discussion about Eugene Peterson and the recent controversy of him making statements in favor, apparently in favor of gay marriage, and then partially or completely retracting that. And so then the larger question I think that comes from that is really how do we judge and evaluate our heroes or our leaders? What is permissible?
Well, and I think that the church has had to ask that question in context of President Trump and his personal character flaws in this last year.
Absolutely.
And how many other controversies have we had where leadership? I mean, you look at a guy like Billy Graham, and you're just like, oh, there's no controversies. He hasn't embezzled any money. He hasn't slept with his secretary. He hasn't. I mean, but those are few. It feels like those are few and far between.
Well, and those kind of controversies have happened in his own family, which just indicates how pervasive that kind of scandal.
Apparently, we're sinners. So
shocking.
Yeah. So keeping it with Eugene Peterson just for the moment. So Eugene is like. I would say most Christians who have read Eugene Peterson, let's take the message off the table.
Right.
Because that's not really what I feel like is the significant contribution that he brings. Like, that's what most people are familiar with. But he's written a lot of pseudo-scholarly, like, I would call it accessible scholarly mm-hmm. stuff that is intended for the thoughtful Christian leader or Christian thinker. And it's often stuff that, like, he goes into, he deals with Jeremiah, he deals with multiple Old Testament texts and really tries to get at those at a really, really deep level. What were you going to say to them?
So would you say that he takes sort of a tack a little bit like, I don't know, a little bit like C.S. Lewis, trying to make it very accessible and very kind of using common language and really...
I'd say he's more pastoral than yes. Lewis was.
Yes.
So he's very much concerned about the cultivation of the Christian, mm-hmm. Cultivation of virtue and spiritual life mm-hmm. in the individual Christian. And so, of course, I mean, he is a pastor, but his work is very focused on that kind of spiritual development, which, but, of course, Lewis's was, but Peterson seems very concerned with the nitty-gritty and the day-to-day.
And not in that kind of prayer of Jabez, dime a dozen kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Like... really rinky-dink.
So is the question that we're asking, if his work was helpful and worthy of...
So let's just answer that. I'm going to jump in and answer that question.
Yeah.
Eugene Peterson's work is helpful.
Extremely.
The stuff I've read has been helpful in my life.
I read The Contemplative Pastor mm-hmm. earlier this year, and just profoundly moving.
And are you a pastor?
No.
Do you,
but I mean, shaping my life as a Christian. No,
okay,
that's another conversation. Shaping my life as individually, but I found his insights to be extremely applicable to my professional life as a teacher.
Okay, so we're just going to put that on the table as a. So keep going with that thought, David. But like, yes, here's a man who has led a faithful life, doesn't have any controversy. He has not run off with a church secretary, has not apparently embezzled any money, and yet he finds himself in this kind of super controversy surrounding.
So he gets a question asked to him that he maybe wasn't prepared to answer, and maybe he has a position that's different from
unorthodox.
Yeah, an unorthodox position on this issue. Does it mean that the rest of his work should be set aside?
Well, and does it mean that, like, I'm not saying that Lifeway doesn't have the right to, but is there Lifeway threatened to pull his entire work off their shelves? Like, we aren't going to carry Lifeway, mm-hmm. Lifeway bookstores. We aren't going to carry Eugene Peterson's work if he takes a non-biblical or non-orthodox view. Of
marriage.
The question of marriage. So what is the question that I guess, so going back to what you were saying, Amanda, what is the question or what, give us what some of the
yep.
characteristics, what do we draw on? How do we pick our heroes? Because I would say up to this point, Eugene has been somebody I look up to and I have a lot of respect for. And
so what does it take to knock him off the pedestal? Or what kind of a pedestal is he on
in the first place?
What does it take to get you to pull something from your shelves? Because I mean, C.S. Lewis is, you know, second to St. Paul in the evangelical church, as far as influence and frequency of quotation goes.
Yeah,
and there's Augustine a reasonable
and
amount
Luther
of
Luther might pre- yeah.
I can't remember the last time I heard Luther quoted in a sermon.
Well, he's quoted, but he's quoted like six times removed.
Okay.
And
somebody
Augustine's
quoting
like 16
somebody
times removed. Six,
yeah.
But, yeah.
Which, I mean, makes sense with the age, but, and Lewis would be personally, I don't want to say offensive, but challenging for most evangelicals in his personal life and his, mm-hmm. his personal choices.
Right.
Most of that stuff is not well known.
Right.
But he was no saint.
No. So What are the qualifications? So this kind of gets into the, like, so a person's beliefs, are they as important as a person's actions? And there's lots of different schools of thought that have wrestled with this.
Right.
But you do have to weigh a person's actions heavily. And so it's great if somebody says, well, I believe that you ought to not embezzle money. But if they then go and embezzle money, you're kind of like, well, great. So thanks for nothing. And I would say that it's caused me some reflection this last week with Eugene Peterson. So on the one hand, I guess I kind of give him a pass a little bit in the sense I'm not so cynical as some people I've read who said, well, the only reason he retracted his statement was because of money. I think that's kind of a shallow
view of what might be going on here.
Yeah, and I don't. It's hard for me to imagine that Eugene Peterson cares that much about money at 80,
whatever,
4 years old or 86 years old or whatever. Like he has plenty.
Likely, pretty well set up.
If it was a greed issue, he has plenty. You would assume, and that just doesn't feel right.
It doesn't seem to resonate with what can be known of his character.
It doesn't seem. But I also have sat back and I've been like, Eugene, what are you doing? Like,
you know, I think that he was making, okay, this is speculation, but I think he was making a call for,
See, this is where we get into trouble because we all want to be generous towards our heroes.
Well,
but at the end of the day.
But don't we as an evangelical church, we have made some sins less acceptable than others.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly true.
And so what if Peterson was calling for a loving congregational response to people who struggle with sexual sin in their lives?
That's not what he was doing.
But he's 86 and he was on the spot and it was poorly phrased. I think it's possible that he was headed that direction and veered off to the left.
Her eyes kind of went up and towards the left like, I don't know. Where am I going right now with this whole conversation? I think those are all possible things. But it has caused me to sit back and go, okay, Eugene, okay, here's what I don't appreciate about the conversation. So take a position and hold to your position. If you are Eugene Peterson, you need to recognize that you do have a voice that carries weight. And if you're going to be orthodox or unorthodox, be that and be that fully.
Commit.
Commit and come down and be willing. Because it's not like that this conversation hasn't been front and center. This conversation has been front and center within our community for the last 5 years, like within the church community, within the LGBTQ community. Everybody's wrestling with this question. Eugene Peterson has not been living under a rock. He's just been in Montana. Like they do have internet in Montana. He is aware
most
that
of
these,
it.
He is aware that this is an issue. And so I feel a little bit even more less than the fact that he waffled on his position, less than the position he took that he was actually waffling.
Right.
Like, well, how can you waffle on that one? Like, you have to have a position. And I don't care if you. I do care what your position is, but I more care that you're – I can't believe he's waffling.
Okay, so he takes the unorthodox position. My generous interpretation is foolishly trying to prop up a hero. He takes this unorthodox position.
Okay.
What do we do?
David, what do we do?
Well
– And before we decide what we do, we must remember that C.S. Lewis affirmed evolution.
I don't think that's apples to apples, but okay.
Well, Lewis had some fairly heretical stances.
I would say Lewis. Yeah, there's other things, and like you alluded to before, Lewis's personal life is a little sketchy at points, which you know. So
we need to approach this thinking, realizing that the people that we are looking to for spiritual leadership are also fallen human beings. I think it's important to have some lines that can't be crossed. Obviously, there are people who are out there that are preaching false doctrines that it would be very dangerous to use some of their works for example,
anti-Semitism.
Well, I was thinking a little more along the lines of like prosperity gospel.
Well, I mean, but just like historically, though, we would say sure. Anti-Semitism is one of those things. Okay, so let's write Martin Luther out of the canon of evangelical leaders that we can use. What about slavery? Okay, so Jonathan Edwards is out. What about who else can I throw under the bus? What about
pick any church father?
What about fidelity in marriage?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Martin Luther King Jr. is now out.
But you're talking about.
And every president, pretty much in the last 150 years.
But you're talking about personal failings versus strongly held beliefs.
Well, I mean, but Luther was like, I think some church fathers have made the statement that it would have been better if Luther would have died 10 years earlier, because he becomes so anti-Semitic in the last 10 years of his life that it almost negates his earlier writings. And, I mean, Edwards clearly was a defender of slavery. So you can't – I mean, those aren't personal failings. Those are
ideologies ideological
that they
ones.
Were espousing yeah. and putting forward that are clearly – we look back and we're like, that's wrong. That's clearly wrong.
Okay.
So do we throw Luther out? Would we be willing to throw Luther out of Lifeway, or would we be willing to throw Edwards out of Lifeway because of clearly unconventional or unorthodox or just bad theology?
No.
No?
We're clearly not.
Okay. So how do we judge them? So coming back.
How do we judge Lifeway, or how do we judge
Edwards? No, how do we judge Luther and Edwards? Like, how do we go ahead and say they were failures? They failed in this category. Like,
so I think the question you're asking, is it okay to read their other works and to keep your eyes wide open and glean spiritual wisdom and encouragement from their works?
So I think it's impossible to not close one eye in a sense when we read some of the church fathers and just recognize that C.S. Lewis had personal things in his life.
I love how
mess.
You just equated C.S. Lewis with the church fathers.
Yes. And, well, we've been talking about him
the in
whole
the evangelical
time.
World,
and
he
Luther
definitely is. Yeah.
And Edwards and Eugene Peterson. And then the question becomes, what do we do with Rob Bell?
Well, that's kind of what I'm getting to. What do we do with Rob Bell? Rob Bell is a heretic.
Well, on the issue of anti-Semitism, Martin Luther is a heretic.
Sure. Well, no. No.
What?
No.
Wait, what is okay. it? Is it yes or is it no? Are you suggesting that it would be okay to be anti-Semitic?
I am saying...
Is it heresy or not?
I'm saying that anti-Semitism is not an essential issue of the faith. Essential issues of the faith are...
It's a sin issue?
Yeah.
Not a doctrine issue?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
And I would say that Rob Bell is a doctrine issue.
So you're saying it's secondary.
Yes.
How important of a secondary would you say that is?
Well, like, pretty important. Just like I'd say that the...
On the scale, are
well,
you
I think the distinction that David's making here is that it's not exactly a doctrinal issue in the way that the Trinity is a doctrinal issue. It's a sin issue. The way misogyny, it would... definitely have influence on your doctrine, but it's not essentially a doctrinal issue the way that affirming universalism
well,
or
yeah,
or yeah altering
same-sex marriage.
Yeah,
same-sex that's the point we're getting
that's
to.
A doctrinal issue.
You think same-sex marriage is a doctrinal issue?
Absolutely.
So
because the argument for marriage is not a
you're putting it on the same level as
belief
the
in the Trinity, or
you're saying it's a core primary.
I think I have to, because I don't think you can read scripture.
So then you would remove Eugene Peterson from Lifeway. If you were on the board of Lifeway, you would remove.
No.
Why? Because you just said it's doctrinal. He just became a heretic.
So I'm not.
What is it?
I'm not removing. Okay. So saying that.
So you aren't removing Rob Bell?
Shh.
Why? Why can't I? I mean, if it's heresy and it's doctrine. And we're going to remove
you're
Rob
assuming
Bell.
That I said that if someone makes a heretical error, that then we remove them
from if you're John Calvin, you just burn him at the stake.
Well,
sorry.
I think I'm more willing to. Oh wow. Okay, I can't believe I'm going to say this. I'm more willing to burn someone at the stake than I am to say don't read any of their books.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to ignore that and just keep on moving right now. So what are you suggesting? So if it is a doctrinal issue, if...
I'm suggesting that even with doctrinal issues, you can read the work of someone and respect the work of someone while having to edit it for, like, mentally edit it for the heresy.
Okay,
you can,
so
I can read
Rob
some,
Bell.
I don't know. I haven't read any Rob Bell, so
I think we should
I'm
make
clearly
that,
behind.
I honestly think we should make it like a goal that all three of us should read a Rob Bell book and then discuss it and bring it in and discuss it.
That does sound
that would
exciting.
Be a great podcast.
That probably would.
Yeah,
we might Donnybrook a little bit. So Rob Bell's not a good example because I don't know what his heresies are or what his virtues are, but there are church fathers that I read that say things that I absolutely cannot ascribe to, mm-hmm. but still have rich devotional use, rich theological use. So Luther, mm-hmm. absolutely obedient to God in so many ways and so necessary at that point in church history. Anti-Semitism can't defend it, can't accept it, won't read it. And I don't think that anyone should defend it. Well, Luther's so great, so we have to defend everything he did. Mm-hmm. That's just foolishness. Mm-hmm. So when we read Luther, when we read Edwards, who, again, great, great preacher, mm-hmm. and amazing and beneficial writings.
Great theologian?
Yes.
Yes.
Flawless? No. When we read Eugene Peterson, when Eugene Peterson comes out and says something that, sorry, it's heretical.
Where he wobbles. Like,
right.
Yeah,
right.
I mean,
so.
Come on, Eugene. Pick a side.
We absolutely cannot demand doctrinal perfection from any human being.
Okay, but.
Except maybe St. Augustine.
So going back to the original conversation. So we've kind of gotten into two conversations. Because one thing I think we're saying, should we curate what we read? And make certain and draw lines and say, I won't read X,
there are limits.
Y, or Z.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the people, I personally think the people calling for saying all of Eugene Peterson's writings are now null and void because of his waffling on this issue.
Were they null and void last week?
Exactly. If they weren't null and void 3 weeks ago, then they ought not to be null and void now. So I think that's a separate conversation. I think the hero worship question is interesting. What are the standards that you, Amanda, use for your heroes?
That's a difficult question because I don't think I have a lot of heroes, at least not self-consciously.
Ooh.
I probably do subconsciously. I have to think about this.
You do have heroes. Come on. C.S. Lewis is a hero.
Yes, absolutely.
Come on.
Okay. So
that's a cop-out.
Well, so I haven't thought about it. So now I have
to. So C.S. Lewis is obviously a hero.
Obviously.
For you. Augustine is a hero for
definitely.
You. I know you've written on Augustine.
Yes.
You've got a little. Is there like a product placement? Isn't that on Amazon?
It is on
What's
Amazon.
What's the name of that book that you.
Is there? Do we have an authoress?
We do.
In our
we
midst?
Have, yes. An authoress? Why do you got to make it? Why do you have to go there?
Why are we gendering it?
Why are you making it gender?
Well, I didn't want to offend anybody.
It wasn't offensive until you threw the gender specification onto the end of author. Anyway, what's the name of the book?
I
you
have
don't
to think
remember?
About it for a second.
She doesn't.
St. Augustine, from rabble rouser to saint.
Right. So would you say which part do you hero worship, the rabble rouser or the saint?
Well, it depends on my mood. No.
Okay.
Yeah, I love St. Augustine. His writings and his influence on the church, I think, he's arguably the most important figure in church history. And
well,
so
I would argue Jesus and St. Paul might be ahead of him. But
after the closing of the New Testament.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
Moses.
So, Amanda, if we were interested in picking up this book and reading some more about St. Augustine, where could we find such a book?
You could find it on Amazon or in the Kindle store. And I think it's like $3 on Kindle, so you wouldn't even be out very much money.
Okay. So, David, what about you? Who are some heroes of yours?
Well,
did you not think I was getting that? You had all that time while I was talking
totally
to
Amanda at all.
The whole time I was thinking about who Amanda's heroes are. And now
I think that's really obvious who my heroes are.
And I'm just
because you admire C.S. Lewis.
I do.
Maybe
I do.
Half as much as I do.
I find C.S. Lewis's works to be fantastic.
It's a hard question.
It is a hard question.
Well, while David's ruminating, come on, John.
I really respect, and this is a weird person to think of as a hero, but I thought of it immediately. I really respect the lead singer and primary songwriter for Switchfoot, John Foreman. I have identified with so much of what he has written, and he is maybe, I don't know, 3-4 years older than me. And so I've kind of looked at his music and looked at what he's written, and identified with it a lot. And he's been in a stage in life often where I'm right there behind him. So I kind of have the sense that, like, when he's writing a song and it takes 2 or 3 years for it to get released, like, I'm the same age as he was when he wrote that song at that moment. And so I've really identified with him. And he's a pretty private person. I don't know a lot about his private life, but just through his lyrics, I appreciate the person that he is. So that's a contemporary person that I've really respected. Prior to that, I think a lot of authors have been formative for me. I remember doing a research paper when I was a junior higher, maybe, on Bach, and just seeing how how much his life was shaped by his faith. And that was also very formative for me. And then this probably sounds kind of goofy, but I think the other thing that is been radical for me in the last couple of years is just the Gospel of Matthew, and just reading and rereading the Gospel of Matthew over and over and over and over and over and over. That changed my entire perspective on who Jesus was and just the teachings of Jesus. And so it sounds kind of silly to say that Jesus is my hero, but, like, specifically through the context of the Gospel of Matthew, I felt like I had a different perspective on the person of Jesus.
Would you say that the Jesus that we see in the Gospel of Matthew is to the Pharisees, a heretical voice, a preaching a radical vision of their religion?
Yeah, I think Jesus turns everything upside down. And I think when I began reading Matthew, it wasn't so much that I was like, oh, look, he just won up the Pharisees. I started reading it, and the first time or two I was running through Matthew, I was like, oh yeah, he just got them. And then at some point it got into my skin and I was like, oh man, it's kind of getting into me now. Like, I'm starting to feel how I have my own hypocrisies in these areas. And specifically passages that had to do with things like, you know, don't worry about tomorrow. And we lead such lives of anxiety where we're tied to the next text message that we might get that tells us that our servers are down or our project has been put on hold or whatever. And then the other one I think that really I've wrestled with here recently, which kind of leads into what I was going to talk about, was turn the other cheek. And what does that mean? Like, what does that really mean? Does it, in the immortal words of Weird Al Yankovic, a local boy kicked me in the butt last week, so I smiled at him and turned the other cheek. Like, is that what it is that what it means? Like, I think Weird Al may have been more theologically correct than a lot of Christian scholars who have tried to explain that passage away.
Right.
And so yeah, Jesus. Okay, before we move on to my topic and we talk about nonviolence, David, you can't skirt this one.
All right.
You need another hero.
It was really actually helpful for
Larry Boy.
Oh man, you did it again. No, I'm kidding. It was helpful actually to
George
hear you
W.
kind
Bush
of take the take it away from, you know, classical authors. And I would say that somebody that I've really been
Steve Jobs
following lately and and thinking, appreciating their stance on things a lot is Russell Moore.
Dr. Moore. Southern Baptist Ethics Committee, or something.
But I have just appreciated so much his standing for truth in our culture,
right?
In a very loving, honest way. And he's, I've been following him on Twitter, and he's such a he's a fun person.
He's clever.
He's clever. He seems to really. He is just very casual, joking about all kinds of things. Not a, you know, stiff, uptight kind of religious
person. Laid his job on the line.
He absolutely did.
Stand for what he believed was true.
Absolutely.
Very recently, they called for his dismissal at one point, and could have, and he refused to compromise, which there wraps us back around to the beginning again, but.
So would you say that's rabble-rouser, or what was the other option for that
saint?
Book? Saint? Both at the same time?
Yeah.
In he made a speech last year during the election.
Well, yeah, what happened last year? I completely forgot.
just
I'm a little fuzzy on it here.
Get it out from your mind.
There wasn't anything newsworthy that went on, was there?
He gave a speech, and it was about the election, but he never used the word Trump. Ever. He made it very, he talked about our culture and the church selling out and following political leaders instead of God. And it was really a very powerful speech. And I think, as you say, he really did lay his career on the line, and he could very well have been fired.
Right.
So I just really appreciate his courage and his dedication to standing up for the truth. Boy, the first thing he said when the Eugene Peterson thing came out was, that's really disappointing. Eugene Peterson's been a great leader, and this is really disappointing to hear. And that's encouraging. It's in our culture where we are so often bombarded by the world and by untruth, and we're trying to keep our eyes and our head straight on what's true. It's encouraging to see other people standing up for the truth.
So what we never did pronounce on were what the limits are.
So I have some thoughts on that as we've been talking. So I think, a big part of this comes back to character and action over belief.
Okay.
And so for me, and that it's fine if you have good thoughts, but this happened with William J. Bennett, although, you know, a couple years ago, where he wrote all these books of virtue, and then it comes out that he's got this massive gambling problem, and everybody's
what?
Like, you didn't know this?
No.
Oh, yeah. He had these huge debts in Vegas.
That's horrible.
So he wrote all these, made buku bucks on the Book of Virtues. And then
gambled.
And then he had these major gambling issues. Oh. I mean, I could look it up and see if I hopefully I'm not slandering William J.
No,
Bennett.
I
but,
think you're absolutely
yeah,
right.
Validate that I'm. So, but we're talking like hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt.
Beliefs over actions. So Eugene Peterson coming out and saying and affirming an unorthodox position on mm-hmm. marriage is disappointing, but does not call into question his character in the same way as it coming out that Eugene Peterson has had a 40-year-long affair or
yeah.
something. Like, if he cheated on his wife, it would be more damning an indictment of his view of marriage
yes.
than for him to affirm or waffle anyway on the definition of marriage.
Yes, and yet I still also appreciate, like, King David, who again, his actions in light of his sin with Bathsheba, his follow-up actions are incredibly important. Like,
right.
we don't have, create in me a clean heart, oh God, and renew it, or, you know, a right spirit. Like, we all can identify with with Psalm 51 because we can all go, yeah, I screwed up and I made a mess of my life and pretty much everybody was around me. And David gave us that because he had a heart of true repentance. And so it's not that you can't be a screw up.
Right.
That,
well,
that
and,
disqualifies
like,
you. I don't think you were saying that.
Yeah. Like, but like C.S. Lewis's questionable character issues involve a, and I'm one of the
an older woman.
I subscribe to the belief that he probably did carry on a years long affair with Mrs. Moore.
Right.
And ended it at some point before or after his conversion. I don't know.
Right. Right.
But did not live like adultery was excusable.
Right. Right.
Probably engaged in it, but did not live like it was excusable throughout his life. And that there's a huge difference between that and some pastor getting caught in a hotel with drug carrying rent boys, which has happened in recent memory.
Which has happened, among other things. What did you find about Bennett?
So, relentless moral crusader is relentless gambler too, from 2003. William J. Bennett, author of the Book of Virtues and one of the nation's most relentless moral crusaders, is a high-rolling gambler who has lost more than $8 million at casinos in the last decade.
Oh my goodness.
Good grief.
Him and Charles Barkley spend a lot of time together.
So the thing about the about Eugene Peterson that it strikes me, another thing that I think we could probably glean from this situation is that he was caught off guard by this question. And this is a question that is pretty important in our culture and in our society. And I don't think there's any excuse for being caught off guard by this question. This is something that we all need to come to a conclusion about, have an answer for in our lives, so that when
but
we
Eugene
are
could have he could have just passed on it. Like, I think this is a question that he could have easily just said, you know what, I'm 84 years old, I'd rather not weigh in on this one. I'd rather pass. Like,
well, and I think that there's an either or there. You have to be prepared to give an answer or keep your mouth shut.
Yeah,
which is not a skill most of us cultivate in our lives, although maybe we should try.
The mouth shut part or have an answer part?
Maybe both.
Maybe a little bit of both. I know which one I need to emphasize.
All right. David, what were your thoughts from this week?
Well, you know, this week I was, I woke up the other morning to, I woke up and my phone says, Charlie Gard's parents will end the legal battle for his son's treatment, for their son's treatment. And of course, this is the situation where the high court in England ruled that they cannot take their son to the United States for treatment, for experimental treatment, and that he just needs to die, which is a...
I don't think they phrased it that way, but
well,
yeah.
Well, that's not exactly how they phrased it, but that's the reality, and it's just a horrifying thing, and can you imagine putting yourself in that those parents' situation? Is just a horrifying thing to even imagine.
Right.
So this is something that I've been thinking about. I've been just kind of thinking, you know, how would we handle a situation like this? Boy, it'd just be awful. And so I woke up and saw this, and it looked like the U.S. was stepping up, and there was some, you know, perhaps this little boy would get to be extradited, and so it was sad to wake up and see, you know, oh no, you know, it looks like they're giving up. And so I was reading their statement, and two things really. The first thing is that I was reading this and I just thought, oh boy, this is just awful. And then I wandered into the kitchen and started thinking about what kind of cereal I was going to have. And I realized that here I am, that so much of what I think about and there's so much, so many things to worry about in our culture and in our society that it gets overwhelming. It gets tiring.
The media saturation issue.
Exactly. The media saturation is so heavy that I feel like I'm becoming kind of a shallow person. because I don't take all these things seriously when the reality is you can't take them all seriously. I mean, sure, this is a horrible tragedy that this little boy is dying, but let's not forget that there are thousands and thousands of little boys all over the world that are dying. And we can't feel, we don't have the emotional capacity to feel that for all of them. And so this was something I was thinking about.
So just that it's personally destructive to be constantly exposed to things that are moving and difficult and challenging because you cannot give them the kind of attention they deserve and may be sane. Like there's no way to keep up with all of the things that you should care about. You should care about.
Exactly right.
So by doing it, by staying in touch with what's in the news all the time, you naturally have to become a more shallow person and be able to turn from tragedy that needs to be wept over and decide on your cereal.
Exactly right. So that was something I was pondering over and thinking about. And
you decided to cancel your data plan on your phone and your internet at home? And, I don't know, get rid of the TV?
Still haven't stopped checking Twitter. Still check Twitter, still watch, but...
Not living in an Amish paradise?
Not living
Boom.
In an Amish
Second
paradise.
Second Weird Al reference in the night. Welcome to the 90s.
So I was reading this article. I was reading the statement that his parents put out, and they said, you know, that... this is one of the hardest things we'll ever have to do, ever have to say, and we are about to do the hardest thing we'll ever have to do, which is to let our beautiful little Charlie go. And they talk about, you know, how if he had gotten treatment quicker, there would have been a much, much better chance. They're saying that the American-Italian teams were still willing to treat Charlie after seeing both his recent brain MRI and EEG performed last week. He's not brain dead and never has been. He still responds to us, even now. But after reviewing the recent muscle MRI, it was considered that Charlie's muscles have deteriorated to the extent that it is largely irreversible. And were treatment to work, his quality of life would now not be one which we would want for our precious little boy. They both agreed that treatment should have been started sooner. And as I read that, all of a sudden, I felt like my brain started exploding because here she's making all these arguments, and then all of a sudden they're saying, because his quality of life is not going to be what we would want for him, we're just going to let him die. And it seemed that it was almost the same argument that the high court or the doctors had been making. That, well, if a certain quality of life isn't there, it's not worth saving him or
trying the experimental treatment.
Trying the experimental treatment. And of course, I think we have to be so careful in this situation because his parents are under such tremendous stress, and I think we need to
Yeah. We get it. We get it. It's hard. It's a hard situation.
Graceful
and awful.
Yeah,
and it's a hard situation.
But
what?
They are going to let him die because he would probably be essentially a quadriplegic and
So what you're saying is ultimately you're saying you disagree with their argument because initially they were arguing and saying life is worth fighting for, period, dot the end, and now they're backing up because they're like, yeah, life is a quadriplegic, pretty much would suck and we don't care.
Yeah.
Like, we wouldn't want him to be a quadriplegic.
That's it.
So I don't know that I would endorse this show, but in the first season of A Man in a High Tower, there's this really powerful scene where – so the total spoiler alert here if you haven't seen the show. It's in one of the first episodes, but they are – one of the lead characters is driving through the countryside, and it's like ashes start coming out of the sky – and he's eating a sandwich, and he turns to the other person in the picture. He's like, "What's this?" And they're like, "Oh, they're cremating the bodies of the unwanteds in the background." And you realize that these are these are folks who, for whatever reason, didn't meet the Nazi, you know, qualifications for whatever a quality of life issue might be. And then in the second season, again, I'm totally ruining it for you if you haven't seen the show, but
or read the book.
One of the main characters is having to who is a Nazi is having to deal with the reality that his son has some incurable disease that he's going to, I mean, you get the impression that he's, I don't know.
He has like epilepsy.
Yeah. He's having epilepsy. And
he's having seizures.
And so the right thing to do if you're a good Nazi is to go ahead and take your own life or, you know, quietly dispose of. So he's being told by, you know, like the doctors, hey, you need to take care of your son. And so he's faced with this compromise where he's like, I'm not going to kill my kid. But at the same time, if he's like a high-ranking Nazi commander, and so he's faced with this ethical moral dilemma, which is fantastic because
I want to explode because he's faced with an ethical moral dilemma. That's not a dilemma.
Well, it is if you're a Nazi.
Yes, but still.
But our culture is having those very conversations. Yeah. I mean, we're wrestling with those very things, and so.
I don't know. So there are a couple of things in here that I think are interesting to think about. One is I think it's American, maybe it's modern, and more American than anywhere else, idea that if there's a possible treatment, that we have to pursue it all the way to the end. That there's never a point where in American culture it's acceptable to say, you know what? I'm not going to take the chemotherapy or try the, you know, go to the Mayo Clinic and have them run use some drug that's, you know, still being tested.
This happened with my grandpa a couple of years ago when he passed away. He said, I'm going to pursue treatment up to this point and then I'm done. And he was up to, he wasn't being euthanized.
Right.
He just said, look, I will pursue treatment
this point and no farther.
And then I'm not.
And I think that I know that there's a huge moral difference between opting out of treatment, choosing not to go to extraordinary lengths, and euthanizing someone. And obviously the question is a lot more difficult when the patient is not capable of making decisions. But there is, you know, I know Catholic moral theologians have pronounced on what treatments are extraordinary and what are not, so that you have the ethical choice to not do extraordinary interventions, but you don't have the ethical choice not to provide food and water, that sort of thing. So I don't know where the line is for Charlie Gard's parents, but they're not euthanizing him by not seeking an extraordinary medical treatment.
It's right. It's not like they're exposing him.
No. Yeah. And I think that that's a great parallel. But the government stepping in and saying you can or cannot pursue this treatment, that's definitely more ethically dubious than the parents choosing whether or not to pursue an extraordinary treatment.
Agreed.
But if you have a state-funded system, who else makes the decisions?
So if I was going to argue take a completely contrarian position, your point is if the state is in control of healthcare, then they get to make the decision.
Which in the UK,
they are,
yeah.
So that's the problem. You have somebody has to make the decision, and that's what people were talking about back in the early days of Obamacare with death panels. I mean, that was the term that was being used. That's essentially what we're seeing in this situation. The flip side, I mean, if I were going to argue for an alternative, position, it would be very libertarian and be like, you know, healthcare is not a right, and all these kinds of things, and you can pursue whatever you want as long as you can afford it, and blah 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 blah. So those are
makes the decision maker your pocketbook.
Right. I think the hardest thing about this situation is it is difficult because it is the complete one-off. And it's good for us as an exercise in ethics to sit back and say, well, what if? I think the biggest, I think my biggest takeaway on this is pretty much in line with what you were saying, David, which is we kind of have to start with a definition of life and then work out from that definition. So if life is worth pursuing at any cost, then we pursue it at any cost. But is it ethical to go ahead and say we don't have to pursue every end? I think that's the question you really have to wrestle with in this situation.
Right.
Can we go ahead and say, we've pursued life, we believe in life, but do we have to pursue every option?
Is it ethical to not pursue every option?
Right.
As
that's the question.
As an example, you know, just much like your grandpa, we have a older gentleman who goes to our church, who was recently diagnosed with throat cancer, and he's in his 90s, and he's not going to seek treatment. And that's
and I get that.
Yeah,
I totally get that.
No, I've already made that decision for myself.
When you're 90 and you get throat
there's
cancer.
A point. Yeah. There's a point where, and a stage of cancer where, to me, it's just not worth it. But we're rational adults making decisions for ourselves, not parents making a decision for a dependent child. Or
so you're saying young life is more valuable than old life?
No.
You know, the other thing that I would mention, just
blue life is more valuable than black life.
Oh, don't even get
started. Oh, come on.
The other thing that I would mention, I was talking with this about my wife, and she was reminding me about a family that she knew several years ago who had a child who was, I think he lived to be about 5, mm-hmm. and he was pretty much in a vegetative state for most of his life. But she said the couple times that she met him, he was just had a real presence, mm-hmm. and was really a blessing to his parents and everybody that knew him. Like he was really a real blessing. And I think that's something to keep in mind.
And that's a really positive note, but I've read comments from people who are in a long-term care situation and talking about just the devastating effect that having a severely disabled child has had on their marriage and on their life. That, I mean, you hear stories of families where, you know, having, you know, a child with mild or severe disabilities born, and what a blessing and what a joy it's been, and how much they've learned. But there are also a lot of stories, you know, that sure. the very severely autistic or otherwise severely disabled children can just, it can be a huge burden. So
boy, we get into some very thorny ethical questions.
Well, and we can't make the argument based on how we feel about it at the moment. So, definition of life.
Why not?
Why not? We're Americans in 2017. That's what we do.
Well, I'm going to go a completely different direction from where I was initially going to go, because we've had lots of heavy conversations. Thanks, guys. I brought another heavy thing. I was going to talk about nonviolence, but we'll save that for some other week. And I thought maybe I would share some words from John Foreman from one of his recent songs. Because I think it's beautiful imagery that he talks, and it's simple. It's poetry. But I think it kind of dovetails into some of the topics we've talked about. So, this is from their song "Live It Well." Take the burden from my arms, take the anchor off my lungs, take me broken and make me one. Break the silence and make it a song. Life is short. I want to live it well. One life, one story to tell. Life is short, I want to live it well. And you're the one I'm living for. Awaken all my soul. Every breath that you take is a miracle. Life is short, I want to live it well. I want to sing with all my heart a lifelong song, even if some notes come out right and Eugene Peterson's came out wrong. because I can't take none of that through the door. Yeah, I'm living for more than just a funeral. I want to burn brighter than the dawn. Life is short. I want to live it well. So, anyway, it's much better if you get to hear the song, but that song, I've listened to that song. I think they released that last year, and it's been fun because that's a song that I've identified with personally, and then it's been fun because my 14-year-old has really taken to that song. And it's good to see that there is a 23-year difference between Ethan and I, and that we can both identify with the words of that song and aspire to live life well in spite of the trickiness of ethical dilemmas and orthodox views on marriage versus contemporary ones and whatnot.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you for listening. It's been hope you've enjoyed our rambling and hearing us have some good Donnybrooking today. All righty. Well, thanks so much for listening. I'm David.
And I'm Amanda.
I'm John.
We'll see you next week.